Hey guys, welcome back to the Big Move Podcast. I'm your host, Em, and this week I'm chatting with Pamela Druckerman.
There is a very strong idea in France that even though you're a mom, you're still very much a woman with womanly needs and womanly rights. You're entitled to spend time alone. You're entitled to have sort of like quality adult time. You're not just 100% transformed into a mom.
Pamela is a journalist, mother, and the author of 5 books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Bringing Up Bebe, One American Mother Discovers the Wisdom of French Parenting, which has been translated into 30 languages. She writes an opinion column about France for the New York Times and 1843, The Economist lifestyle magazine. She's appeared on Morning Edition, Good Morning America, The Today Show, CNN, and so much more. I loved my chat with Pamela. I just felt like she kept it very real with us when it comes to pregnancy, motherhood, and practical parenting tips, all from someone with a pretty unique lens as an American woman raising her family in France. Her experience is really multifaceted, and I know that I'm personally walking away with a somewhat refreshed perspective, being a new mom myself and an American living in London. I hope you all enjoy my chat with Pamela. So here it is. Pamela, hi. Welcome to the Big Move Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pamela, it's so nice to meet you. I am so excited to have you on the podcast and hear all of your wonderful tidbits and words of wisdom. But first and foremost, where in the world are you talking with us from today?
I am in Paris, France.
Amazing. I am in dreary London town, so a bit of a parallel between us.
Where in London are you?
So I am in central London. I'm in Marylebone.
Oh, Marylebone. I love Marylebone.
Yes.
I say I love Marylebone because I'm like so excited you named a neighborhood that I actually know in London, but it is really great.
Yeah, it is. It's lovely. It's very quintessential London. So we enjoy it very much. So Pamela, do you mind giving our audience just a brief, quick background on who you are?
Sure. So I am a journalist and author. I write books mostly about cross-cultural problems and differences. And since I live in Paris, I write a lot about France and about the capital. And I write 2 different newspaper columns, one for the New York Times and one for The Economist, for their magazine. And it's sort of all about life in France and just the foibles and awkwardness and challenges and triumphs, very small triumphs of daily living.
So Pamela, on this podcast, I love to hone in on our guests' quote, big moves. So whether it's moving to the new city, the new country, or launching the brand or writing a book, you've obviously done so many of these amazing things. But what I'd love to hone in on with you specifically is your move abroad to Paris. Can you tell us about your initial move to Paris and sort of take us back to that time period for you?
Sure. So I never planned to live in France. I never even studied French, nor did I aspire to live in France because I know it's a dream for a lot of Americans to live in Paris. I had visited, but I did never plan to live here. I grew up in Miami around a lot of people speaking Spanish. I was fascinated by Latin America. I studied Spanish. I worked as a journalist in Latin America. I lived in Mexico and Brazil and Argentina. And on a trip to Argentina, I met a fellow, a British journalist, who was there for a week writing a story about soccer in Argentina. He's a sports journalist, or he was at the time. Now he's not. Now he's broadly a sort of generalist. And so we got along, and I decided to follow him to, he happened to be living at the time in Paris, so I followed him to Paris, knowing really nothing about the French, not speaking French, and not having any sort of dream of living in Paris, as I know you're supposed to have when you move here.
Sure. Wow. And I think what I'd love to kind of dig into there is, what was the sort of initial emotions for you when you moved over there? Did you know any French? I mean, for me, I would be so scared with the language barrier. You know, I came over to the UK and obviously there is not one. I know English
but
and speak
is.
It.
There is kind of a language barrier.
Right, right.
There's a cultural barrier.
Yeah, absolutely. But right, I'm curious between, you know, the language barrier and as you said, having to sort of start from scratch in so many ways, like what were you feeling emotionally?
Well, I didn't think language was going to be a problem because my Spanish was really quite good at that point. And I figured, well, they're both romance languages. What could be so hard? So I sort of like went around Paris speaking Spanish to everyone, which really what I should have just done was gone around speaking English to everyone. Because, of course, like now in Europe, English is the lingua franca. It's everyone's second language. And even the French speak it quite well, although back then they weren't quite as good. But so people looked at me like I was really lost. Like, who is this American girl speaking Spanish in a boulangerie in Paris? And I would say my overwhelming emotion was loneliness and displacement. I think there are places that you can move to and that I have moved to in the past where the place just swallows you up. Like, you know, people say, you know, they move to New York and within like a week, they feel like they're a New Yorker already and they're shouting at people and giving directions. And Paris, it just is not like that. It's austere. It's forbidding. The weather is terrible for like 7 months of the year. I moved at the beginning of winter when it was just like gray skies for 6 months. And no one spoke to me. No, it was indifferent. Like I did not make a sound. Like nobody knew I was there. Nobody knew or cared that I was there. So it was challenging. I mean, it took really a couple years to feel like I even had my footing in France.
Absolutely. I'm sitting here nodding because I can relate so much to, you know, that feeling of loneliness that you feel. I guess I'd love to ask if you have any tips for someone who's maybe doing a similar move or, you know, doing that big move abroad from whether it's the US to, you know, Europe or any part of the world that they're just not familiar with.
Well, I mean, one thing that's really helpful, I think all over the world, radio is really important and more than it is in the US. I mean, we listen to the radio, but it's like in a lot of countries, it's the primary way that people like sort of connect with the zeitgeist of their country. And France is one of those places. So even before you move here, one great thing to do would be to listen to like France Culture and France Inter, the sort of NPR equivalent stations. And you can watch French television. But just to sort of get into the ambiance of the country, the sounds of the country and the issues of the country and to build up your language skills, it's a way to sort of be immersed in France without even being in France yet. There's so much you can learn about a place remotely now before you get there. I would take advantage of all of that. And I should probably mention, like, you can study French all over the world by going to, for example, the Alliance Française in St. Louis.
I love that. I've actually never heard this tip, and I feel like it's extremely practical and tangible. So thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
So Pamela, can you talk us through your career and sort of what got you into writing initially?
Sure. I started out as a kind of traditional journalist. One of my first jobs was with the Wall Street Journal. I was covering Latin America. So I started, you know, covering the news and covering a lot of economic and financial news for the journal, also politics. I was a foreign correspondent for them all over Latin America. I would sort of parachute in when there was an election in Peru or Venezuela and quickly write the story and go on to the next one. So it was very exciting and exhausting and isolating. And I would say that I was a decent journalist. I kind of did the job, but I always felt uncomfortable writing in the sort of omniscient voice of newspapers where, you know, this is what happened in the world today. This is what you should care about. And I appreciated being on the receiving end of that, but it didn't feel like a perfect fit for me to be providing that. I always felt like there was so much going on, and why was the news not what was happening in that like shoe shop on the corner? And why was it what the president was saying? And And so I had the experience of writing for the art section of the journal, a first person piece when I was living in Brazil on taking samba lessons. And literally it was just me and a friend going into a dance studio and trying to learn how to dance samba, which I thought was mysterious and fascinating and really, really hard. And I wrote a first-person essay about it. And it was a time when not a lot of people were writing first-person essays in newspapers. You didn't hear I a lot. And all I did was just very precisely describe my own tiny little world and experience. And the article didn't go viral. Nobody read it. But it was the most satisfying piece of writing I've ever done, because I just felt like I had said something true. And so from there, I ended up leaving the journal. And, you know, I didn't like immediately start writing that way full time, but I was sort of set on this path of writing in the first person from my own experience and trying to, instead of drawing, you know, starting with this kind of universal, I was hoping that by writing about something that was true to me, I would say something that was, just because we're all people trying to figure the world out, would be true to other people too. And so the journalism that I've and writing that I've done since then, a lot of it has been a blend of really serious reporting, you know, doing interviews with people and reading social science research and trying to kind of figure out what's going on in the world, but also blending that with my own experience and doing really storytelling. And even, you know, I wrote a book about how the French raised children, which was in many ways anthropological and sociological, and I relied on a lot of research and interviews, but I told it through the story of my own parenting, and I really tried to put it in the shape of a story with suspense and a kind of beginning, middle, and end. So I would say that's in very broad strokes, is the story of my professional career. Is I'm in my the columns I write and in the books I write, I try to really tell a journalistic true story. Except in my most recent book, which is a children's picture book, which is fiction.
Perfect. And yes, we have more questions for you around the children's book. But thanks for bringing up Bebe. It's obviously been such a success, really globally. I'd love for you to share a little bit more. I guess what sparked the title of this book?
You know, it's a play on the film called Bringing Up Bebe, which was I think it was a Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn film. I can't even remember now. It's a really old movie. But Bebe in the film is a tiger, I think. I haven't actually seen it. So it was just a play on that.
Okay,
and I should say that there's the same book has a British edition, and it's called French Children Don't Throw Food. So one book has two titles.
Okay, perfect. What do you think has made this book, you know, such a success all over the world, or maybe has, you know, helped it stand out versus some other books in a similar category?
I think that all over the world, the demands on parents have increased a lot. You see this in the statistics, like even working moms today spend much more time with their kids than stay-at-home moms did kind of 30, 40 years ago. There's been this phenomenon since about the mid-90s of, it comes by various names like hyper-parenting, helicopter parenting, intensive parenting. And it's just this idea that the world is like a competitive place. And unless your kid starts reading early and you do all these development exercises with them, that they're not going to be in the middle class and get into the right college or have the right career or have the right preparation. So parents have become in America, but also in many, many other places, especially as economic inequality has increased, extremely anxious. And so my book is, I found that it was different in France. I mean, there's anxiety in France. There's parents who do crazy stuff here too. But for the most part, the general norms are very different. They're much calmer. The idea is that the child fits in with the rhythm of the family, that the parents don't just like completely overturn their lives to orient everything around their kids. I think there's a, you know, in America and in other places, people are parenting in a way that feels kind of crazy to them. And not in every respect, but in some respects, they're thinking, why am I doing this? Is this really necessary? What are the alternatives? So bringing up Bebe and other books in the same vein are trying to say, look, there are alternatives. They've been here all along, and here's how they work.
Absolutely. And I have a bunch of, I guess, more specific parenting questions relevant to that title coming up a little bit later. But in the meantime, I'd actually love to ask, are you able to share more about the book becoming a movie anytime soon?
A lovely actress has signed on.
Ooh, yes, I love it.
It's not, you know, it's still in development. So I don't have any details, but there's a wonderful company producing it, and and the character's name is still Pamela Druckerman in the script, which is I think is hilarious. So we'll see if it stays that way.
Great. Well, needless to say, something to look forward to. So can you talk us through one of your other latest titles, There Are No Grown-Ups, a midlife coming of age story? What can people sort of expect from that one?
Sure. So that book I wrote basically about entering my 40s and entering kind of midlife in France, where like literally you know that you've gotten older because the waiters in cafes go from calling you Mademoiselle one day to like 2 weeks later calling you Madame, with this like little interim period where they call you Madame ironically, like with this little wink, but then the wink goes away and you're just like a full-on Madame. And so I was traumatized and fascinated in equal measures, which I think is like always a good recipe for writing about something. And I wrote a book about what midlife is like, how it is different in different countries. Do you get wiser as you get older? And if you do, what do you know in your 40s that you didn't know before? So it's a kind of like a coming of age story, but for middle age.
So Pamela, I know you and I were kind of chatting briefly before we hit record, and I'm just going to reshare. So basically, I found your book and your story and you as an author, admittedly, when I became pregnant. So my sister-in-law had your book, Bringing Up Bebe, on her coffee table, and I picked it up and I knew immediately I was going to love it.
That's so sweet.
So
that's like our meet cute moment.
It is. It's our meet cute moment. I love that. So yeah, I poured through that during pregnancy, and especially, you know, the parts around pregnancy I was really relating to, especially at that time. So I'd love to dig in a little bit. What would you say are some like key cultural differences when it comes to pregnancy between like the US and then Europe and France?
Well, I would compare more France with the rest of Europe and America, because I think France in some ways kind of stands alone. Although I know the most about the US and probably the UK. But I'd say I had the impression when I was pregnant that the most appropriate response to finding out that you were going to have a baby was to become like extremely anxious and to start worrying about everything and to figure out all the rules of what you can and can't eat and can and can't do. And I found that the pregnancy literature was almost like designed to make me think about all possible horrible things that could happen. And the French literature was all about baby zen, like how you're just supposed to be incredibly calm and the best thing you can do for your baby is to not worry about anything. And some of this is structural, like, you know, there is national paid maternity leave in France, which there isn't in America, of course, and all kinds of other support for even mothers-to-be, let alone mothers, in France and in Europe that we don't have in the U.S. So there's a reason to be calmer, and there's a reason to be more anxious in America. But yeah, it was more, and that kind of sets the tone for parenting differences generally. I think American parents are supposed to be anxious and guilty, and that's even valorized. Like, the more guilty you feel about not spending time with your kid, the better parent you probably are. It's a kind of virtue signal. Whereas in France, that kind of thinking and anxiety, even once your kid is born, is not valorized at all. It's sort of, people think it's a little bit strange. Like, why would you ruin the experience with all this anxiety and guilt?
Sure. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I guess when I was pregnant, something that I just kept running into over and over, and I'm sure a lot of women listening can relate, is, you know, you look something up like, can I eat this? Can I eat that? You know, especially like around like even just sushi and seafood, there's this gray area where you don't know which way to go. And so you just stay away from it. Like, uh-huh. Is that, I'm sure that's something that you ran into just with writing and the research that you were including in your book.
Yeah. I did not find that French women just drink wine throughout their pregnancy and drink and smoke through their pregnancies and don't worry about it. I think they're quite cautious about that here as well. But certainly, like, on the margins, it seems like there's a whole, I don't want anyone to listen to this and like go out and order sashimi.
Right.
But it seems like there's been a lot of research, and there are a lot of foods that are, you know, in a very small percentage of cases can be dangerous, but in general are fine. That we as Americans think, you know, categorically we're going to rule these types of foods out during pregnancy, when in fact they're probably fine, and it's just sort of another source of anxiety. Like, I remember worrying about Parmesan cheese, and because I didn't know if it was pasteurized or not. Like, mm-hmm. And I think that those kinds of details are probably, especially if it's going on top of hot pasta, like, probably not so much of an issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we're trying to like look for the rules and follow the rules, and also in America, we are. We are obsessed with like different kinds of diets and ways of eating. And so pregnancy brings all those habits as well. We're looking for sort of more food rules.
Sure. No, that makes so much sense. So I guess moving into a bit of parenting from, you know, babies, toddlers to kids the same age of yours, which, by the way, how old are your kids currently?
15 and 12 and 12.
15, 12, and 12, right? Because you have twins, yes.
So they sleep through the night now.
They sleep through the night. It is a win.
It's a win. It gets better. That's what I want to tell new moms always, just it, because I, you know, in France too, like, people really suffer at the beginning, especially if their kids aren't sleeping. It's torture. Like, you're literally being sleep tortured. Mm-hmm. So it really does get better, better and better.
No, it's good to hear. I guess on that note, what are some French ways of parenting that you think have been maybe positive for you and have worked well for your family and your lifestyle?
I think everything around food has been really amazing for us. You know, my kids eat oysters and love all, you know, they have some things they don't eat too, but I mean, they're not picky eaters. They love food. They love being at the table, having long conversations at the table. They expect to, you know, the French famously like spend more time at the table. They don't eat more, but they spend more time just like sitting around the table and chatting and eating than people almost any place else. Certainly compared to Americans. They just actually passed a law in France during the pandemic temporarily that says it's okay to have lunch at your desk at an office, because before there was a rule that said you had to at certain companies like be in a cafeteria or be in a proper food setting. So anyway, I think my kids are very much intuitive the French way of eating, and they're and I think that's a positive, because it seems like a small thing, but it's you have meals three times a day, and being able to all eat the same thing, to explore, to travel and explore through food, to be excited together as a family about tasting all kinds of new foods. It's it is kind of changes the flavor of family life.
Absolutely. And I had many people reach out to me too before you were coming on the podcast asking about this specifically. Like, how do we avoid having a picky eater? And I'd love to kind of ask you, like, where do you think this lies with the French? Like, how are they doing it so well? Do you think it's, and I'm feeling this too from being over in Europe and living in the UK, is it our access to really local farm-to-table food? Is that part of it? Or where do you think it lies?
No. It's not about having like special organic food, or it's about, okay, so the French do a bunch of things. One is that they tell kids from the very beginning, you don't have to eat everything, but you do have to taste it. And it's been scientifically shown that, okay, so everybody likes ice cream from the first bite, but like with many foods, you have to taste them 10 or 15 times before you like them. And if you give up on the third try, and you say, my kid just doesn't like broccoli, I accept that as a fact of the world, then you lose that food. And so just making kids take a bite and preparing the same food different ways, presenting it differently, and presenting that joyfully, not saying like, here's this terrible thing, but I'm going to make you taste it, but saying this is like one of the great pleasures of the world is eating pureed zucchini, and here you are, here it is for you with a little bit of maybe cream in it the first few times. That's a way to introduce, to treat it as if you're like introducing kids to this like cornucopia of wonderful flavors. And that's your role as a parent to do that. So that's one thing. The other thing they do is they don't let kids snack between meals, except for this one snack in the late afternoon that's like a codified snack, the goûter. So that means it creates this virtuous cycle where when your child comes to the table, he or she is actually hungry, which a lot of, if you're snacking before dinner, you're going to get to the table and not be excited and want to leave. And then they serve food in courses. So the first thing that hungry child sees is, let's say, chopped up tomatoes and cucumbers or some kind of salad or something, but it's vegetables. So the vegetable course comes first when the kid is hungriest. And so all of this, and they don't make meals too long for little kids. They try to follow the natural rhythm of the child, but they, between not snacking, serving vegetables, good vegetables, deliciously prepared vegetables first, and say you just have to take a bite. I think those three, and doing it all with kind of joy and not treating eating as a food as a battleground or a burden, that kind of sets the framework for a healthy relationship with food.
Okay, got it. So it seems to me like there's just a lot of discipline on the adult to just sort of like stick to their guns with these things.
It gets, maybe at the beginning it feels like a big effort, mm-hmm. but I think after a while it actually makes things much less stressful because it's going smoothly. You're not having an argument about, you know, whether or not your child is hungry or what he's going to eat. Everybody eats the same things. Maybe not in the same quantities. It just creates this pleasant atmosphere, I would say, for meals.
Absolutely. So what would you say are maybe some of the biggest differences between American parenting and French just in general?
I think for women in particular, there is a very strong idea in France that even though you're a mom, you're still very much a woman. With womanly needs and womanly rights. You're entitled to spend time alone. You're entitled to have sort of like quality adult time. You're not just 100% transformed into a mom. And I think, we talked a little bit about the government's role in that. And I think should not be underestimated. The fact that like in France, school starts at age 3. Preschool, all kids have a spot in free public preschool from the September of the calendar year that they turn 3 years old. And in America, it's 5 years old. So that's, and even before preschool, there's subsidized daycare, even just for a few hours a week. So we talk a lot about family values in America. But what I see in France and all over Europe, and France isn't even the most generous place for all these services, you really see that mothers have support, so they can work and they can have some time to themselves. They don't feel completely overwhelmed by motherhood.
I love the first piece too you said about just feeling empowered to that alone time, you know, being a new mom and being just thrown into it, not having felt like your life has done this like complete 360, you know, degree change.
Yeah. I mean, I would meet when I was doing interviews for this book, and I still meet moms like this who, American or British moms who have like a 5-year-old and have never spent a night apart from that child. And they're exhausted. And I think what the French would say is like, you need with anyone, your child, your spouse, your friends, like you, your family, like you need time apart to appreciate each other, to just recover yourself and then come back together and enjoy each other's company even more. So I would meet French parents who would say like, oh yeah, once a month we drop the kids at the grandparents and we just like have a weekend, have a naughty weekend to ourselves. They wouldn't say naughty, but I kind of got the feeling that's what it was.
No, that's amazing. So what would you say are maybe some of the biggest challenges that you've run into as an American raising 3 kids in Paris?
Knowing the system, knowing the schools, like understanding what the American equivalents of different things are, the holidays, the like relentless school holidays. They have 2 weeks of school holidays every 6 weeks. So just when you're recovering from one vacation, it's like, boom, there's another one. And you have to plan that too. Like vacation planning is like a major facet of French life. And actually, I became a French citizen and I had to take a test in order to do that. And one of the questions on the test was like this multi-part section of how to plan a vacation and matching the vacation to the needs of the person. And I could see like that really is a skill here.
No, that makes sense. So I know at the start of the Paris lockdown, you co-founded something called Pandemonium U, which is a series of free Zoom classes taught by world-class experts. I love if you could share just a little bit more on like what this is and maybe what sparked that for you.
So at the start of the pandemic, my husband and I suddenly realized we were going to be stuck at home for a while. And we know all these wonderful people through our journalism and just through living in different places. So we thought, what if we bring these people to an audience? So we started what we called Pandemonium U, which is U in quotes. It's like, it's as if it's a university, but it's not. It's just us interviewing people. And we've now we call them classes that are about 50 minutes each with dozens and dozens of experts on different topics from around the world. So we recently had, a lot of them are French themed. So we recently had a woman who wrote a biography of Coco Chanel. And she talked to us for 50 minutes about, it was a talk called Coco Chanel, the woman who dressed the world. She was amazing. And we showed lots of pictures. We've had a lot on French history. We had a biographer of Macron, the French president. We have lots of people with books out talking about their books. We had the woman who did the TV series Unorthodox talking about that. We had Apollonia Poilin talk about how to make bread. Any topic, we had a woman talk about how to drink French wine, and we sent everyone the names of the wines ahead of time that we were going to taste. So it's just a chance to have a really intensive curated conversation with people from all over the world who are stuck at home too on their area of expertise.
That's awesome. And I feel like I've been talking more and more to people about just the kind of the wonderful things that are coming out of this lockdown period. And it sounds like that is certainly one of them. What an awesome resource. Do you think that's something you'll keep going even in like a post-lockdown world?
I don't know. I hope so. We have, more and more support for it. And we've gotten the nicest letters from people who've said that it's been like a kind of lifesaver for them during the pandemic. But I don't know if we'll continue, but I would like to. But it's pandemoniumu.com if anyone's interested. We have a newsletter that goes out telling people about upcoming classes.
So Pamela, I have a few rapid fire questions that I have fielded from our Instagram audience. So we will just jump right into those. Do you have any favorite places to spend time in Paris?
I'm a big tennis player, so I really like playing tennis in the Luxembourg Gardens. That's my all-time favorite Parisian activity. I also just like really walking around the city. I think that's, you can't go wrong with that.
Okay. Do you have a top food tip to avoid having a picky eater on your hands?
I would say if your child rejects a food, bring it back in a different way, like put some cheese on top of the broccoli or puree it or fold it in with an omelet. But just keep bringing foods back in a very positive way.
Perfect. And this third question, admittedly, this question is from my husband. So bear that in mind, because I don't think it is a black and white response from you. So should you pick up a toddler when they are crying?
Yes. I don't want to be the person who tells you not to pick up a crying baby. Sure. I mean, the idea of French parenting is to listen to your kid and to connect with them. It's to show them affection and love. It's not to be cold. I guess you know your kid and you know their circumstances. So it depends on the situation. But I would say for the most part, you know, the more you can communicate and pay attention to your and observe your child, probably the better off your whole family is going to be.
Perfect. I'm going to relay this feedback to him. So Pamela, I read in one of your recent articles from The Guardian something that just really struck a chord with me being an American living abroad. So I'm going to share a quote from the article. So you wrote, "I'm a bit of an alien here, a foreign plant. I read somewhere that the longer you stay, the more American you feel. I think there's some truth in that." I'd love for you to elaborate a little bit on this for the audience. Any like tips, tidbits, and experience with that?
Well, I think one of the great joys of moving to a foreign place is that you see your home place with new eyes. And that's not just in the first 2 weeks. I mean, I've lived in Paris a long time and I'm still learning more and more about America, even just through my own assumptions about parenting or about food or about any aspect of life, about education. Like it just all shows me how deeply American I really am. I don't think that ever goes away, but it's not a problem. It's a delight. I mean, you become more and more a kind of anthropologist of your own culture, and all the information is inside you. It's kind of fun to just kind of observe yourself in that way. Plus you're learning about the new place and kind of picking up some tips and adopting some of their habits. But you're never transformed, especially not in a place like France. You could sort of, I mean, people who come from the provinces never really feel Parisian. So how am I supposed to?
Absolutely. It's just like, I feel like it too, just the longer you're here, it's all about just these different perspectives kind of coming into your purview, and they change you, but you're right. I completely relate to that.
But then your kids become something else that you can't control entirely.
Absolutely. So Pamela, what is next for you? Is there anything that you want to share with the audience before you go?
Well, I have just come out with a children's picture book called Paris by Phone that is based on Bringing Up Bebe, or I should say sparked by Bringing Up Bebe, but it's its own story. It's in rhyme, which was incredibly fun for me to write. And I worked with this amazing French illustrator named Benjamin Chou, who just added like so much verve and humor to the book. So I'm really excited about it.
Amazing. We cannot wait to pick that one up. So thank you. And a last question, where can everybody follow you, find you, and keep up with you?
PamelaDruckerman.com is my website. I post my articles there and links to books. And I'm on Twitter at Pamela Druck, and I'm also on Instagram. I think I'm also at Pamela Druck on Instagram.
Perfect. Pamela, thank you so much. I loved our conversation today, and thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks so much for having me on. It really was a pleasure.
Amazing. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you found value from this episode, please share it with a friend. Tag us on Instagram at The Big Move Podcast. We always love to hear your feedback, and we will catch you on the next episode.